You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning to everybody. My name is Kathy Moon. I am non-resident senior fellow at the Center for East Asia Policy. My previous incarnation, which ended June 30th this year, was SK Korea Foundation Chair of Korea Studies, the first holder of this position. And for a variety of reasons, I had to return to my teaching position at Wellesley College. I was commuting, actually, from Boston to Washington every week, so it was difficult. But this is a place, an institution with incredible resources, intellectual and camaraderie resources as well. So I'm very, very happy to be back. This is the second annual Young and Brave Next Generation of Korea Experts Conference. And I want to explain to you a little bit about the development of this conference. We actually even have alumni and alumni in the audience, or they'll be joining us throughout the day. I think a good 3 to 5 of them from last year's crew will be joining us. They have formed a very tight-knit community, and I'm sure that this year's participants will be enlarging that community of young folks in their 20s and early 30s who are going to take over many of the jobs that you might have right now, many of the jobs that we hold as people in our 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. Young and Brave, we decided at Brookings to have a conference that focuses on or features people in their 20s and early 30s, not as trainees, not as people who need to come to Washington to learn about Washington, but people who can teach Washington, who can be public educators and public intellectuals with new insights, new research, and new visions appropriate for their generation that will affect policy development and studies regarding the Korean Peninsula in the future for the decades to come. As you know, if you live here in Washington, most of the time it's folks who are older who speak, and the young folks, our staffers, they take notes. This time at Brookings, we are the only Next Generation conference sponsors among several Next Generation organizers at various think tanks and universities. We are the only ones who feature young people as the main speakers. What we did also is not choose topics and have others accommodate us, Brookings, but we asked each participant that we had sought out what he or she would like to speak about, what his or her expertise or what his or her own passions in terms of interests regarding the peninsula are. And so we truly catered to the interests, the strengths, and the desired messages of these participants. So it is a unique opportunity to hear them and to learn from them and to engage with them. Why young? Well, when you see them up here, you will see. I don't won't have to explain why we call it young and brave. They're really young, okay? Again, in their 20s, and the oldest is maybe early 30s or so. So, you know, the geriatric part of this panel really ends at the early 30s. And it's done on purpose. Brave. Why brave? Because in my view, it takes courage to study the Koreas and in the future to manage issues related to the Koreas. Because the Koreas and the region are filled with such a breadth and complexity of truly life and death issues, potentially, violence versus peace. Even in the best of circumstances of a reunified Korea under peaceful circumstances, huge dislocations of populations, huge challenge to democracy, which I hope will endure and grow on the peninsula. But there's no guarantee about any of these things. any of the achievements that South Korea has brought to fruition unless the process of unification, if and when that happens, takes place in a stable, peaceful, cooperative way. And that's wishful thinking as well. So it takes bravery, intellectual courage, bravery of character, and I'll explain why, bravery of character to examine unpopular views and approaches to the Koreas that are not in vogue or that are considered too idealistic or too unrealistic or too potentially disruptive and so forth. As you know, Washington, Seoul, so many places in the world that actually work on the Koreas are so polarized by ideological differences. What I find fascinating and hopeful about the younger generation of scholars last year and this year, and by scholars I mean students of Korea in general, is that people have different views, but they are so open to exchanging them, to respecting other people's differences, and not putting up walls between one's views and someone else's views and approaches. And I think this is a vast improvement on the older generations, my generation and older included. We all grew up in the Cold War era with Cold War mentality, where it was black or white. And this generation is post-Cold War. This generation is much more globalized, and they are much more open to various types of information, various types of interpretations in ways that my generation and older were not willing to entertain. Intellectual courage, bravery of character, and also courage to be creative. God knows right now we really need some creative, innovative thinking regarding the Koreas. We can't just continue with the past 20 or so years of a North Korea whom nobody knows really what to do with or how to deal with. And a South Korea who's been progressing so much on the economic front, but lately has been regressing some in the democracy front. And so democracy, economic achievements, we must stay vigilant. And God knows in the United States we need to stay vigilant about democracy. And you all know what I mean. But we're talking about Korea today. I won't get sidetracked because we know that if we all get sidetracked with the American elections, that we're lost. We'll be here for the whole week. This year's group, as an introductory remark to introduce them, reflects and advances trends among the younger generation of thought leaders on the Koreas. And I would characterize them as this way. The younger generation in their 20s and 30s, they are highly experienced, even though they are very, very young. And they're highly experienced in very substantive ways. I don't mean just reading books. I don't mean just doing social networking participation and throwing their little blurbs out there. They are true thinkers and analysts. They also are very diverse in their professional and issue areas of concern and experience. I have been amazed at the cross-fertilization and cross-ventilation that these young folks last year and this year have been partaking in. They do not belong to one professional silo, which my generation and older, we all had to choose a silo. If you're in academia, you shouldn't be messing around with NGOs or government or think tanks or media. You should just focus on your academic work, and that's how you're going to be promoted and succeed. If you're in government, you have to be wary of NGOs and media, et cetera, et cetera. The younger generations don't think that way. Almost every one of them has experiences in the academic world, starting with studies on the Koreas from their undergraduate life, through many of them, their graduate experiences. Many of them have been contributing as writers to various types of media, both online and offline. We have editors, founders of major Korea-related online resources. SinoNK, Korea Economic Watch, 38 North, various programs from SAIST. I find that really interesting. And also, the same person has also had, in many of the cases, experiences in the NGO world on human rights, on humanitarian issues, on a variety of issues. So media, the private sector, academia, government experience as well, policy worlds, think tanks, research institutes, you name it, and they've already done it at the age of 25, 26, 30, 31. Again, this is a huge difference from the older generation who did not have this kind of cross-fertilization and cross-ventilation as part of their everyday existence dealing with the Koreas. So I think this bodes well for our future. And to tell you how globalized they also are, many of them, if not most of them, have lived in various countries, and I'll name just a few. Korea, South Korea, and I'm talking really living there, South Korea, Germany, China, New Zealand, Australia, where else? Sweden, Belgium. Did I miss any? And the United States and Canada. And those are just some of the countries. The languages that they collectively share to offer you, Korean, German, Chinese, ancient Greek and Russian, Spanish, French, Indonesian, American English, British English, Australian English. Did I miss any? It's an incredible group, and I've been amazed at how fluid they are in their thinking, partly because they have access to different languages and they can access different sources of information. They are not boxed in people, and I think this bodes well for the future of policy experts, of academic experts, researchers on the Koreas. So with that, we'll start off with our first panel, which is just a conversational roundtable. And I invite the panelists to come up. Thank you. Are we ready? Do we have your mics on?
Yes.
That's it. Go.
Yes.
No. We had a welcome dinner last night, and we had great fun. So they're also a very fun, loving lot. I'm going to make the introduction short since you have the bios in front of you. And if you don't, they're in the hallway outside. So you can read about all of their accomplishments in, you know, two decades or 2.5 decades or 3 decades of their life so far. I will make very brief introductions. Steve Denny is a PhD student in political science at the University of Toronto. He's also the founder and editor, one of the founders and editors of SinoNK, which is a major website. And we became Twitter friends before we actually met, which is now the way that people seem to meet. So very happy to have Steve here. He lived 21 years in the U.S., 7 years in South Korea, and 4 years in Canada. So this is already starting out to be an interesting lived experience that we'll benefit from. We have Benjamin Silberstein here. He is a PhD student at the University of Pennsylvania in history, Korean history, Asian history. You are also a co-editor of North Korea Economy Watch.
Yes.
And Steve and Benjamin have done lots of writing. You can find their articles, all sorts of media contributions online. Benjamin is originally from Sweden, 16 years of his life in Sweden, 4 years in Belgium, 2 years in South Korea, 3 years in the United States. You're seeing a trend here that these are not people who are fixed in one location, and so hopefully they're not fixed in their mindsets either. Sharon is from Australia, 25 years in Australia, South Korea, 1 year, and 1.5 years in the U.S. And Sharon is the U.S. coordinator, I want to get it straight, of North Korea Strategy. What's the last?
Center. U.S. Center. Program Officer for North Korea Strategy Center.
Yes, North Korea Strategy Center. I always go by the abbreviations. And she is the person in the United States based in New York City who manages issues related to NKSC, which is headquartered in South Korea. She has a lot of experience in dealing with NGOs, NGO work, and on a variety of issues, not just the Koreas. And we have, last but not least, Poo Hung Hyun, who is a student at Columbia, and Poo Hung has a fascinating history. Spent the first 14 years of his life in North Korea, 5 years in China, 3.5 years in South Korea, 2 years in New Zealand, 5 years in the United States. He is the first student of North Korean descent to study at Columbia and at such a fine school. He also was elected, I think it was about a year and a half ago, to be the first ever president of the International Korean Students Association, the first president of North Korean descent to represent everyone else who was from South Korea. Speaks a lot to his leadership, his integrity, and his capabilities that he was honored in that way. Poo Hung also is very active in various NGOs, in writing, in advising on various matters. And I find that his U.S. experience also is very diverse. He had 3 years in the Republic of Texas and two years in the People's Republic of New York City, Manhattan. So with that, we will start off with some questions I had provided them to engage in a good conversation. One of the things that I've noticed about your group, and this panel in particular, is this diversity of residences, language, and international experience. And so I am wondering in what ways your backgrounds, these backgrounds, have shaped and influenced your thinking. So how has your experience living in multiple countries with different knowledge about the Koreas and different foreign policy interests toward the Koreas, how have they influenced the way you, quote, see both the North and the South? You're welcome to focus on one particular country that you've lived in or multiple. You're welcome to focus on views from the outside on North Korea or South Korea or both. Let's start out with Steve.
Thank you for the kind introduction. My research focuses primarily on identity, so I'm going to answer this question from an identity point of view. Identity is not really what you think you are or who you are. It's what others think you are. You got that? Benjamin and I were talking in the hallway just a moment ago about this, and he said one thing that we learned about spending time in Korea is that Koreans have certain predispositions. Right.
We're getting
Benjamin and I were talking in the hallway about this very thing, about identity, about how what others think you are. And Koreans have certain ideas about who Americans think they are that is quite different from what Americans think they are. And I think this critical reflection upon who I am and upon who we are as Americans is something you can't learn if you don't leave your country, if you do not exit the silo, so to speak. And I think that being in Korea helped me more critically reflect on the idea of being an American and an American in identity. And it's something you can't experience unless you leave.
Okay.
What about Sharon?
Yeah, I think, Stephen, you touched upon something that we were speaking about this morning as well. You can't sort of get a sense of how you might be perceived when you're in the careers unless you get a chance to go there and unless you get a chance to leave your home country. I spent 25 years growing up and living in Australia. I now predominantly work on North Korea-focused issues. And North Korea is not, I guess, one of the sort of priority areas when it comes to policy making in Australia. It felt very much like a foreign and distant issue that the US was tasked with leading to resolve. Having spent some time in South Korea and then coming to the US and seeing sort of the shift in different countries' perception of their burden to resolve the North Korea problem was really interesting. I think it's also really important that you consider how you might be perceived by Koreans in your work and studies towards them. That's something that I think comes with experience being in the country.
And Puhum?
Okay. So I was born in Korea and raised in Korea. So it's my Korea is my country, but what I learned from living in outside of the country is that even though it's my country, it is also a part of international community. That's one thing I realized living in overseas. The decisions we make for our country, both, you know, it could be applied on South Korea and North Korea. Actually, it influences other countries, and especially like nuclear issues and the decisions made by North Korean government. When I was there, I didn't know or I didn't be aware of how it is actually influences on other countries. Today, I clearly see this each single decision actually creates a lot of tensions and anxiety among nations, especially in East Asia. That's something I learned from living outside of the country when I see the country from outside of a perspective.
Curious, Puhung, if I could ask you to think about this a little deeper. Even in the United States, and of course in Korea, mm-hmm. you've lived in both the North and the South.
Yes.
What kinds of differences, let's say, between Texas and New York, the two republics, did you perceive mm-hmm. regarding the Koreas? How do people in Texas, wherever you were, Texas is a big place, obviously,
right.
How would you compare their views versus New Yorkers' views? And then if you think about having lived in both North Korea and South Korea, some of the similarities or differences in the way that they regard peninsular issues.
Mm-hmm.
We know what we read, but beyond that.
So actually, I prepared that question for the second question. I prepared the answer for the second question, but let me pull it up. Today, I see North Korea has developed a very distinguishable culture by them, you know, their own culture. So even though it is we were the same country and we were we shared thousands of years of same history, it has turned out very different country. We speak same language. But different dialogue, but it's not the major point. The way people think, the way people see the government, the way people treat themselves is totally different. The difference between New York and the New Yorkers and the Texans is maybe some cultural difference or a little bit of a political, difference. But the difference between North Korea and South Korea is like from east to west. they don't see each other as same country or same. They regard themselves as brother. I mean, Korean, same Korean ethnic group, but still North Koreans treat South Koreans as their enemy, and still believe that they needed to liberate their brothers from under the control of the United States. We can talk about it, you know, for hours.
You also lived in China, and
right.
What are your impressions of 5 years in China, having lived there, the Chinese that you were around, or the Korean Chinese that you were around, their views of the North and the South?
Okay, so a lot of Westerners, we think China is a communist country. But when I first get to China, when I was 14, to me, China was the most capitalized country. You can do, there's nothing that, you know, everything is possible to me in China if you have money. You know, in a communist country, it is impossible, right? Theoretically, but everything is possible in China. That's what I found out in China. Also, the way Chinese people see, so Chinese, I spend most of my time with Chinese Koreans, and they are descendants from they are descendants of Koreans and South Koreans and North Koreans, but today they just you know wanted to come to South Korea and to be a South Korean citizen, because South Korea is more richer than North Korea.
So money talks in China. Ben, you have the sole, I guess, European and Asian experience. And when we say that Benjamin has been in Korea, you've also done trips to the borders via China, I assume,
yes.
Right? Via China. He has a lot of experience working with Swedish and Nordic experts on the Koreas. And as many of you know, Europeans, and especially the Nordic countries, are way ahead in their knowledge base of North Korea, specifically because they do have diplomatic relations, and Sweden in particular was the first since the 1970s to maintain diplomatic relations, and Sweden represents the United States for governmental interests vis-a-vis Pyongyang. So based on the reality that you know of the broader and deeper knowledge base in Europe and in the Nordic countries and in Sweden, what are some observations you can make about the way that Swedes, Nordics might view the Koreas versus Americans, South Koreans, etc.
Well, if I could start by turning the question around real quick, and just because I think one of the interesting aspects of being Swedish and studying the Koreas to me is that you really have no enemies when you're doing it. You don't have the issue of, well, if you want to meet with North Koreans or travel to North Korea, you have the added problem of, well, I'm from a country that's at war with North Korea. You don't have that issue as a Swedish person. So when you travel to South Korea and you speak to people who work on issues related to the Korean Peninsula, you're regarded as a friend. And the same is true for when you go to North Korea, usually, and when you meet with people from North Korea. So that's a really big advantage. When I've traveled to the border, for example, and I've tried to speak with North Koreans who are in China in a working capacity, who transport goods across the border, for example. One time I even took out my Swedish ID card to really show that, like, look, this is the country I'm from. I promise I'm not American. There's no, and I love America personally, but as you all know, there's a little bit of sensitivity with meeting Americans if you're from North Korea. So that's something that I've tried to use to my advantage a lot. Definitely.
And the issues, the perspective on issues.
Oh, the perspective on issues also gets very different, I think, in a country like Sweden, where, in a way, yes, you're definitely part of sort of the Western U.S. allied security community, but you're also not in an armed conflict with North Korea, which makes a big difference. I think the range of interests might be a little more diverse, perhaps, in Sweden, where I think in America, for very good reason, a lot of the work and the research on North Korea is done from a security perspective deep down. Like, that's even if you're working on humanitarian issues, a lot of the times the core reason for the interest is security. But in Sweden, you don't really have that presumption that North Korea is a security threat first and foremost. It's also a humanitarian issue, sort of. Both of those issues are on the same level, I'd say.
I think that's a very important difference. There's just a wider agenda for Swedes and Nordics. But what's your sense of diplomacy? Where does diplomacy fit in the U.S., in South Korea? Diplomacy is really, really difficult, even to talk about having, not formalizing diplomatic relations, but even engaging in diplomatic talks is in and of itself seems like a near impossibility at times. But in Sweden, in the Nordic countries, in many European countries, the EU, people have diplomatic engagements with North Korea all the time. What kinds of what have people been learning? What was the role of diplomacy in improving knowledge, improving relations with North Korea?
I think the most important aspect of that is really keeping the channel open. I think that's really the core interest for most Swedes who work on these issues. It's also because I guess not as much is at stake for a Swede or for the Swedes who are engaged in diplomatic communications with both North and South Korea, because of the lack of the sort of security based sensitivity. But I think the Swedes who have been involved in diplomatic engagement have been able to learn a lot just only by the virtue of continuing to talk. There is a fascinating, I've been waiting for this a moment to bring up this one person, and I guess I'll just do it right away. There is a fascinating potato farmer from Sweden named Sven-Erik Johansson. I don't know how many of you have heard of him. Sven-Erik Johansson. He lived in North Hamgyong province for 8 years, I think, and worked on a potato farm there. And I just think that this man says so much about what you can do when you're a neutral country, neutral small country that doesn't sort of make a big fuss about itself. I think he left only a few years ago, and I would love to ghostwrite his memoirs for him. I think that'd be phenomenal.
It's also important to keep in mind that a lot of these European countries and others that have diplomatic ties with North Korea have a more consistent sense of an institutional history regarding the North's changes, developments, one step forward, five steps back, or multiple steps back, than those of us in the U.S. or South Korea or Japan or elsewhere who can only get little snapshots at a time. And so anytime I've spoken with Europeans, I find that resource, that intellectual resource of a longer sense of history, a longer sense of what's changed, what's not, who are the players, who are not, very, very valuable. Let me move on to another question, and I think Puhung is waiting since he's prepared so hard for this one. This is a conference about generational differences, generational change. In all of you, I want to ask, but in your opinion, what kinds of generational differences have you observed in your country of origin? And Stephen, if you want to talk about South Korea, having been there 7 years, that's okay, even though you're originated from the United States. But in the country that you have lived in a long time, and you can choose, what are the generational differences you have perceived about the way people regard the Koreas? What might older and younger generations teach each other about the Koreas and about the future?
Okay. Okay. Can you hear me? Right. Okay. So, my country of origin. So, let me go back to North Korea again. The difference, first, let me talk about the difference between my parents' generation and my generation. I would say the biggest difference is the loyalty to the government. My parents' generation was born right after or during the war and educated in during 60s, 70s, and they got the full education under this central distribution system. And they have memories of the great leader, Kim Il-sung, and even Kim Jong-il as well. But my generation, those who were born late 80s and the early 90s, we don't actually, we are very independent from my parents' generation, especially from the government as well. Because when we were growing up, as we all know, you know, the great famine took place in middle of the 1990s, and that because of the famine, the government couldn't provide food to the people. So the central the government runs distribution system was broken, and because of the economic hardship, my generation was forced to go to markets to make money and buy food. So we don't actually remember or have less memory, or some of the younger people younger than me, they even don't have the memories of receiving, you know, gifts from the government. I think that's the so that made us less loyal to the government. Even government sometimes government could be an obstacle to us, because they regulate and impose a lot of labors on us. And the second thing is my generation, maybe if I ask the lessons from my parents' generation, would be don't trust the government. My parents' generation, they were loyal to the government. They were the people who made North Korea rich in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But what they gained today is nothing. A lot of people actually died during the starvation. So if I ask my mom or my father, what lesson could you give me about the government, especially North Korea? I'm sure she will say, don't trust the government. I think that's mentality. That's the mentality what my generation in North Korea has today.
This is interesting. Bhuang's parents are also now living in South Korea as South Korean citizens, so the whole family's together. So in one sense, they had loyalty, but in a way they felt betrayed by that loyalty because they were disappointed. And your generation and younger don't expect anything from the government. Is that an accurate description?
Yes. We don't expect anything from the government, and we want the government not to ask us to go to field for free labor.
Okay. This is very interesting. Stephen, curious, maybe your perceptions of generational differences in either the U.S., South Korea, or both?
I think I'll just focus on South Korea. It's interesting that, seeing as how I haven't lived in the U.S. for 10-plus years, I've kind of lost touch in a way. I've lost a sense of my Americanness, perhaps, and that's not such a bad thing, because I've gained it a sense of ness in other places. But it's actually a core focus of my work. Yeah. And I'm gonna forward an idea, my reading of some relatively recent data, which highlights, I think, some interesting generational differences and similarities. There is a survey that's run by East Asia Institute, the Asan Institute for Policy Studies, and other organizations in South Korea that seeks to understand how South Koreans see North Korea. And they ask a pretty standard question. Do you see it as a friend, an enemy, a neighbor, or other? And what's interesting is that if you break it down by age cohorts or generations, you see that among those who say enemy, those who share that opinion are the youngest and the oldest. It's about 19-20%. I think that's interesting because clearly they're from different generations. But is it safe to assume that they will thus have different opinions? Perhaps not. And I think perhaps that is something to consider, that just because sort of the conditions of our existence have changed or are different, it doesn't necessarily mean that our opinions will be different. In fact, they're often the same. But in this case, in this specific case of the way in which South Koreans see North Korea, I think it might be because of different generational experiences. The older South Koreans, so 60s, 70s, they experienced great hardship. And many of them associate that with the Korean War, and they fault North Korea for that. Whereas younger people have grown up in times of plenty, in abundance, great material conditions, and they see North Korea as threatening what they have, and thus they perceive it as an other, as an enemy. And in that way, perhaps, there is some similarities between the way in which even young North Koreans see South Korea as an enemy and the way in which young South Koreans are increasingly seeing North Korea as an enemy. I don't know what to make of that. It sounds worrying. It's something to be addressed. But things don't always get better, and sometimes we need to recognize when something isn't and seek to address it.
Excellent. Let's go to Benjamin.
You mean how people in Sweden regard...
Generational differences.
Yeah.
And what each can teach the other based on your experience there.
Well, I think there are differences in the focus of people's interests. We were talking yesterday at dinner about the interest in North Korea versus the interest in South Korea, and Dr. Moon said, which I agree with, that North Korea is winning in a way, the PR war, because people just not because people have a more favorable image of North Korea, but because the interest is just a lot greater. And that's definitely something that I've seen in both in Sweden, and I really think in the U.S. as well, that when you talk about Korea, and when I tell people that I work on Korea, it's not assumed that that would be South Korea necessarily. People always ask North or South, which is a perfectly valid question, and my sense is that greater interest is definitely sparked by North Korea rather than South Korea, just because North Korea is perceived as more, obviously, as more of a mysterious enigma. So for better or worse, I think if I would think of generational differences in Sweden, I think the older generation was very much colored by, I think among the people who actually care, which sadly are not the entire country, but a lot of those who cared deeply in the older generation were veterans from the Korean War. Sweden was a participant on the UN side in the Korean War, and whenever I write about Korea in Swedish papers, I often get letters, sometimes emails, from people who participated in that effort. And there's also my sense is that adoption used to be a much more central theme for people who were interested in Korea. In the older generation, a lot of them were people who adopted children from Korea, whereas now it's more of a general audience that's interested in knowing what's really going on in North Korea. So,
you bring up an interesting point that Nordic countries had adopted large numbers of Korean War orphans, post-Korean War orphans, etc. And so there is this contingent of people of ethnic Korean descent who are Swedish. And it'd be a curious thing to study. You know, what role do they play, if any, in featuring issues related to the Koreas in the Nordic countries? I'd like us to move on to I have two questions remaining that I've been curious about, and you're welcome to pick up any one of them or add to any of the comments that your colleagues at the table here have stated. One question is about how international should we be looking or regarding issues related to the Koreas versus regional or versus alliance-driven? And by that I mean that most policymakers in the U.S. take a regional approach to the tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Most people assume that the U.S. is the major player when it comes to peninsular issues. Japan, South Korea certainly have this view. And China, of course, considers it its own regional issue, different from the U.S.'s. And in Europe, I think there is a sense of ceding ground, ceding a certain ground or ceding a certain kind of respect to the United States as the great power in the region to manage Korea-related issues. But I say this out of genuine concern. In my view, whether we have conflict or we have a stable, formal peace on the Koreas in the future, there are going to be so many issues related to even the best of scenarios in unification, dealing with migrants, dealing with economic need for integration, dealing with political guidance for how to bring 25 million people and 50 million people together. A South Korean society that is no longer ethnically homogeneous versus a North Korean society that has been inculcated in xenophobia. What do we do with all of these issues? And so I'm curious, what are the roles that the international community, that different countries around the world can play? Why shouldn't the stakes be theirs? Why shouldn't it be, you said the stakes aren't as high before for the Nordics versus Koreans, Japanese, Chinese, Americans, but why shouldn't they be higher? What can the international community do? What should it be doing now to think about future scenarios regarding the Koreas? Let's start out with Ben.
So I agree that the stakes should be higher for the international community. I think just pragmatically speaking, it will be very hard for me to imagine Nordic countries that have, I think Sweden has a combined amount of 5 soldiers in permanently stationed on the Korean Peninsula. That really matters, I think. I think concrete connections and concrete interests, whether we like it or not, really do drive these processes. What we can do to change that, I don't know. I think, again, going back to the specific case of Sweden, Sweden likes to call itself a humanitarian superpower, which I think is sometimes a little braggy and not entirely true in all cases. But I think I wouldn't worry too much about countries such as Sweden being there on the humanitarian front with, if need be, one day with the Korean Peninsula. Sweden does do quite a substantial bit of humanitarian work in North Korea, not as much as I think Swedish NGOs would want to do. But yeah, I don't have any clear answer advice, I'm afraid.
But I think it's something we need to keep in mind for the future, that we need to pool resources from all over the world to assist the Koreas if and when. And, of course, the scenarios we can leave as question marks. Sharon, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think I'm probably sitting in kind of the same thoughts as Benjamin. A couple of years ago when I was living in South Korea and I was trying to get a sense of what civil society and NGOs in South Korea were doing with regards to the North Korean problem, I had a South Korean friend, an older male, say to me, "Why are you so interested in North Korea? Like, why do you care so much? It's a Korean problem. It's not your problem. You don't have to care about this." And I didn't have a good answer at the time. I thought North Korea's always been, I guess, a fascinating area for me as a student of international relations. And I didn't have a good answer at the time. Having come into working with an NGO that's working in what I consider to be quite an exciting area of North Korean affairs, which is increasing access to information in North Korea, I think that we can look beyond state-based and state-led approaches to resolving the North Korea issue
and we have opportunities now to engage civil society actors all over the world. We work with a lot of European NGOs who are very proactive in supporting initiatives that focus predominantly on, you know, affecting and impacting North Koreans in North Korea, the people, and not necessarily the government. I guess I still don't really have a good answer to that question, but
I asked the question because people don't have good answers, so we need to collect the bits and pieces and try to put them together. Steve, you have any thoughts on that?
I was thinking of Wada Haruki's latest book, his updated book on the Korean War, and it's entitled The Korean War, An International History. And he focuses on the number of international actors who were involved in the conflict. And I think sometimes people tend to forget the international nature of Korean affairs and the responsibility for the international community to ensure that a similar conflict doesn't arise once again. I feel sometimes a bit preachy when I'm asked my opinion about Korean affairs as an American. America has played an enormous role in the region and continues to do so. I think sometimes the best answer might be to not let Koreans deal with it themselves entirely, but to look more resolutely at what Koreans are doing to resolve the problem themselves, because they are doing a lot. I will talk a bit more about during my presentation, so I hope everyone stays for it. But South Koreans' government, civil society actors are aware of the changing demographic makeup of their society, and they've done a reasonably well job at making adjustments to accommodate or to try to accommodate newcomers, from North Korean migrants to wives who are resettling from Southeast Asia with farmers in North Jeolla province. And from what I've learned, they're doing a pretty decent job. So perhaps we could turn the tables a bit and ask, in a world which is increasingly becoming more xenophobic, where the discourse on sort of dislike, discomfort, or mistrust of others in society has been normalized by some individuals, thinking of one in particular. I mean, what can we learn from others who are facing similar transitions? So I would like to maybe turning the tables, challenging the presuppositions, as someone who is both young and brave, to say, what can Korea teach to us? 29,000 North Korean migrants live in South Korea. And there are problems, of course. Social tensions arise, etc. But they're doing pretty well. Why? I wonder if anyone can actually answer that question. Because there are answers, and they're there if you want to find them.
Thank you. So my last question, this is your personal views here. Based on your experience with young people who study and work on the Koreas, what is the most encouraging or positive thing your generation can offer to the future? Puhum?
I think you skipped the third question for me.
If you'd like to.
I prepared, so okay. Let me speak a word.
He's truly a good Korean. He does his homework.
So what are the role of international community, you know, can help play on North, on Korean issues? Is that their role could be bring reconciliation between North and South Korea, you know. So since South Korea and North Korea, we have tension between the two countries for a long time, it's hard to talk to each other. As we see today, you know, there is no, you know, higher official talk between the two countries, or no exchange of information or culture between small organizations, NGOs. So this role could, you know, like international community, like, you know, Sweden or, you know, New Zealand or Australia, those countries could take this role in favor of Korea to Koreas. And also, what we can do is to prepare the unification. My friends and I are really willing to, you know, devote our lives for our country, both North Korea and South Korea. So I hope to see North Korean defector young professionals in variety of different fields in South Korea and in the United States, you know, like politics, economics, or, you know, culture. That's the way that we actually, that can be my or defector's contribution to our nation, but at the same time, that we believe that I believe that it will be beneficial to both Koreas and the world as well.
And with international support and participation, mm-hmm. I assume you're saying. So why don't you continue and tell us, based on your experience with young people who study and work on the Koreas, what is the most encouraging or positive thing your generation can offer to the future regarding the Koreas?
I was struggling with this question at least, you know, over an hour, because I couldn't. It's very good question, but I couldn't get something to tell. But what I've just decided to share is, I think my generation in South Korea and even in North Korea are very open-minded. And that open-minded perspective, we don't know what we could offer for the future, but we actually, you know, that's the open-minded perspective could encourage us to the venture, to start our own venture for the future.
Okay, thank you. Ben?
Yeah. So I think the most encouraging thing with people in our generation who study and work on the Koreas is that people are bothering to learn the language. I really think that matters more than anything. I think there was a time when maybe studying the Koreas was such a new thing that you could write very interesting stuff that hadn't really been written about before, not knowing Korean. But I think we're at a point where that's kind of, it's getting harder and harder to do. And I see more and more people who are working in this field who realize that you have to do your, at least, you know, a couple of years or so of hard work in Korea in order to be able to do what you want to do ultimately. So I think that's the most important thing and something that is very encouraging.
And we do have the Washington representative of the Korea Foundation here, who happens, the Korea Foundation, as many of you know, fund many programs around the world to encourage the learning of Korean language, Korean culture, sponsoring folks to go to Korea to learn about Korean language and culture, etc. And I would add, as an academic here, I find this absolutely necessary. This is the fundamental need to learn Korean in Korean contexts, but also in diasporic contexts, because Koreans, being Korean or learning about Korean, by being Korean, I mean in a global sense, it's not just about living in Korea. There are diasporas all over the world, and in a way, different Koreas all over the world. And so that is important, and I think having the language, getting Korean history, Korean culture, Korean literature, political science, social sciences regarding the Koreas, it actually equips scholars and analysts to be very, very deep in their knowledge base and very confident in their policy critiques and ideas. My generation and older all came to the study and policy making of toward the Koreas via China, via or Chinese studies, via Japanese studies, via Russian studies, or via international arms control studies, anything but a focus on Korea. And I think that is such a promising thing for the future generations, that this generation and younger, hopefully with more funding from various organizations, will continue to really solidify their language and their historical and their cultural understanding. And then, of course, the challenge is, in the future, we also need to have an open mind to learn about North Korean historiography, North Korean customs and cultures in the different regions, the dialects in North Korea. Many of the defectors who come to the South don't understand South Korean any longer, partly because it's so Americanized, right? So we're going to have to do new kinds of learning about the Korean language and Korean culture in the future as we see the inter-Korea relations unfold. But I think this is an excellent point. Sharon, and then we will have Steve with the last comment on this question.
Sure. So I think that we're lucky that we, I guess, haven't been doing this long enough to be fatigued and cynical, especially when it comes to working with North Korean issues. I work with a lot of young college students who are just so enthusiastic and passionate, and they're not just learning Korean anymore, but they're also aware that they need to pick up another language in the region. So they're learning Chinese, they're doing Japanese, they're doing Russian. It certainly makes me feel a little bit inadequate. And we've really gained from that. We've had, I distinctly remember we had an intern who was proficient in Chinese, and we were doing a research project on meth abuse and trafficking in North Korea. I wanted to look at Chinese sources, but I can't read Chinese or understand it. So with his help, we were able to pull up these really interesting primary sources that referred to China's official response on North Korean drug issues. So that's really exciting. I think, yes, the language cannot be underestimated. I think also there's a hopefulness and a deep compassion that comes with a lot of young people's interest in the Koreas. And I think you really need to bring that into your work, especially when you're working on something as challenging as North Korean human rights issues, which can feel enormous and sometimes insurmountable.
Thanks. I think I want to plug SinuNK, SinuNK.com again. It was mentioned previously, but there's a point here, and it's not just about SinuNK. It's about similar organizations. There's a greater understanding of the value of collaboration today, I think, than there was in previous times or generations, that young scholars are more willing to work with, write with, and travel with people who are not in their department, who are maybe not in their country. I would consider my core group of colleagues to be those who are affiliated in some way with SinuNK to a large extent, including a lot of people up here and some in the audience here today. And they hail from many different countries, different backgrounds, different departments, and they bring different skills to the table, methods, languages, predispositions about how the world operates, and a different approach to understanding our social world. I think that's different, and I'm kind of repeating what I've been told by people who are older than me, so maybe that's what they're recognizing, and I'm internalizing this message. I think they're right, and I think this is a good thing, because I think it's helping us overcome the silo that departments create, or that countries can create. And I think that I would encourage everyone to be committed to that if you're not, or to continue doing it if you are, because it's a bit challenging. But I think with advances in communication technologies and the ease of travel, it's possible. It's more than possible. It's almost easy if you want to do it. And I think it's really neat. And I've learned so much. And I think my understanding of Korea and the world is so much better because I talk to someone from the Netherlands and someone from Hong Kong. I write with them. I collaborate with them. We share ideas, angsts, etc. And I think that's making us better off. So I think that's something positive about new developments in our generation. That's recognized by the older generation. So let's harness that.
Wonderful. And a great note to end on our opening roundtable. We get so much bad news about the Koreas, and it's nice to hear good news and hopeful news of better days to come. So thank you very much. And we'll move on to the next panel at 12:45. You have about 5 minutes if you need to take a break. Thank you. I'm sorry.
But it looks like Colombia is
similar,
right?
Yeah, it does, right? Yeah.
I'm hoping we make jokes in that
time. Sure, they have that.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. Good morning. I know you're stretching your legs out, getting to see old new faces, but I'd like to ask you at this time to take your seats so we could get started and have more time for discussion at the end of the panel. Thank you.
Oh no, Paul said it'll automatic when it's come up.
All right, good morning, everyone. I'm Eileen Block, part of the ASEAN Institute for Foreign Policy Studies, and I'll serve as the moderator and discussant for our second panel today. We will now explore two overarching themes of this conference on identity and power, and we already heard a little bit earlier this morning, and I hope we could dive a little deeper into these topics. So we're going to look specifically on how nationalism, national identity, and power in South Korea intersect and how they're interpreted at home and abroad. We'll also look at how power in identity and its societal and economical value, while also looking how that power inhibits or encourages change in identity itself. So we have a very good star lineup of experts here today to help us go into these topics from different perspectives. And before our panelists join me on stage for a discussion, I'll invite each one to the podium to give their brief presentation for about 10 to 12 minutes. And following that, we'll have our own discussion and open that up to the panel at around 11:30. So first and foremost, I would like to invite Dr. Chiun Bang to the podium. And while you come up, I'll do a brief introduction of what you're going to be showing us today. So Dr. Chiun Bang, she's a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Michigan, and she received her PhD from the USC. Her research interests include international relations, theory, security, and Northeast Asia. Drawing from her doctoral project research, Jiun will examine the business of nationalism in Northeast Asia and how that is packaged, repackaged, and sold as commercial interest. More specifically, she will approach the issue of territorial disputes in the region by using this framework. So without further ado, I want to give the floor to Jiun. Thank you.
Great, thank you for coming. I'm going to go straight into my presentation. Today I'll be talking about nationalism, but in keeping with this theme of being brave, I'm going to give you a very different interpretation of nationalism, and I'm going to talk about where political activity meets the marketplace. And hence, the numbers below this barcode are actually GPS coordinates of the contentious territory of Dokdo Takeshima between Japan and South Korea. And I think it encapsulates this idea of me talking about commercial activity with politics. So how did I get into this in the first place? I was reading this very dominant popular discourse in nationalism about elite manipulation. And basically it talks about how elites are able to tap into nationalist sentiments to sway the masses to their favor. And I thought there were a few weaknesses. And so for one, what I call immaculate conception. So we are to believe that as soon as the words leave the mouth of the elites, they somehow travel and impregnate the hearts and minds of the masses without really even knowing what the specific conduits for the transmission really is. And so second, it relates to the first point, the public is seen as very passive consumers of this nationalism, and so there's a very clear division of labor between who is doing what. And so third, relatedly, there's not much interaction between the government with the masses in making the nationalist narrative. And so last, there's not much interaction between markets and politics at all. Taking this into consideration, I'm basically arguing that all else being equal, greater commodification of nationalism will result in greater bilateral tensions. And I look specifically at territorial sovereignty because it's a very non-controversial issue that gets to nationalism. What does this all mean, though, really? Instead of treating nationalism as an emotion or affect, even maybe a movement, I'm treating it as if it were a commodity that can be produced, consumed, and reproduced on the market. And so I can reinforce this link between why people really buy into nationalism. I talked about why I care, so I want to give you a bit about why you should care, the contribution, right? So first, I'm treating nationalism as a variable rather than a constant. And to talk a bit about what this means, just as consumption waxes and wanes, so too does nationalism if you think of it as a consumption behavior, right? And so there's a tendency to treat nationalism as only going in one direction, which is up, but rarely do we think about the downside, so when it decreases. And taking it as a commodity this way allows me to think about it as a more dynamic variable that waxes and wanes. Second, I can decouple nationalism from violence. So again, there's a tendency to couple nationalism and also tensions with violence, but I actually look at sub-war level diplomatic political disputes. And third, and most importantly, it explores consumerism with citizenship. And so how does the marketplace afford a new space for one to express one's political identity, right? And it brings up a very, very interesting question about if I'm a producer of nationalism, is it a very liberating behavior as I become more empowered through profits that I make in the market? Or is it a very oppressive behavior as I become more tied to the state and the state cause? So am I an extension of the state? So I'm going to talk a bit about my independent variable, which is the explanatory variable, or the causal variable, and it is commodification. And so the easiest way to think about this is along this matrix of you have consumables, also called tangibles, or you have non-consumables or intangibles. And so under consumables, you have things like food, beverages, and clothing. So think about a T-shirt with a big, loud message on territorial sovereignty. And for non-consumables, there are experiences. So tourism, museums, even nationwide competitions that give prizes for the best impressive essay on territorial sovereignty protection. Right. So the attribute of these foods and drinks, they're portable, they're also very multifunctional, and they in some way streamline the message in a very clear manner. And the attribute of these non-consumables is that they are very participatory, and so the consumers can really get into this process of developing the nationalist rhetoric. And to give you a few examples of these consumables in particular, so things like a restaurant that serves diaoyu, also known as Senkaku Islands, noodles and soups, or you have Takeshima manju on the left, you also have Tokto bread on the right corner, and you have some Northern Territory snacks on the left in the middle there. just some few examples to get the message across. And so let me talk about the dependent variable or the outcome that I seek to explain, which is tensions or bilateral tensions. And so it's a very important point here that I go over this, because the tendency for us to think about tensions is only two ways. Those are type 1, dormant tensions, and type 4, maximal. And by this, I mean when we think about low tensions or high tensions, the volume and intensity always go in lockstep. And so when we think about high tensions, we think about war. Oh, East Asia, it's close to war because we have high tensions. And that's because we are linking volume with intensity. And actually, I create a typology where I disaggregate the two axes. So you could have more types of tensions that not necessarily go to war. So these blue types, quadrants, are new tensions that you can see if you disaggregate volume from intensity. So things like type 2, homeostatic. So you could keep having low-level tensions, but a lot of them without drifting into war. And my logic is, by talking about commodification, we can really think about how it differs from militarization, because it doesn't impact necessarily the intensity, just the volume. And so you might ask, how am I measuring tensions? It's a very difficult task. And I decided to construct a database of bilateral summonses in Northeast Asia. And a summons is where the foreign ministry of one country calls in the ambassador of another country to express displeasure or discontent over a certain issue or dispute. And so I looked at all the summonses that occurred between or among the countries of Japan, South Korea, and China between 1998 to 2015, which gave me a database of 184 points. And as you can see, it does wax and wane, which is very different to what the media will tell you about. It's just been up all the way. And I wanted to do a more in-depth case study. So I looked at, I overlaid the empirical existing territorial disputes in the region with my typology of tensions. And so I have Temado Tsushima Island between Japan and South Korea in type 1, and Tokto Takeshima, the homeostatic version, in type 2. So my theory suggests that volume should be affected by commodification, so I decided to look at those two disputes. And just to, the advantage of doing this was, not only are they the same two countries, but different disputes with varying levels of tensions. To give you a very brief evidence for the case study that I did, so the first one is Temado Tsushima. And as you're probably, what your gut is telling you, it's a very low case of tensions, and there's also a very low case of commodification there. But at one point, South Korean tourists overtook the entire population of Tsushima City in 2001, so there was a lot of tourism. And if you do careful process tracing, you see that there was a very action reaction from when we see increased tourism and Japanese government becoming very worried and concerned about investments and injections of money by South Koreans, which is a very different case to Tokto Takeshima, where we see a lot of commodification and quite a bit of tensions. And what is very interesting is this 2005 Tokto Sustainable Use Act that the South Korean government passes. And this just creates a very whole of government, let's infuse money into the island sort of approach. And not only that, there's a very big increase in tourism. As part of this DSUP, the government scraps the cap on how many people can visit the island daily by 2009, which in effect has a 9,000% increase in tourists to the island, and of which only less than 1% are foreigners, so it's mostly South Koreans going as tourism. And this is another very interesting chart. So I thought, quantification, everyone's so interested in quantification these days. How can I quantify something? And so I had a very hard time trying to think about how I can quantify this level of commercial activity or commodification. And I decided to look at trademark applications. So how many businesses, including subnational governments, are applying for trademarks? And so in their name of the business would have something like Tokto Bread or Takeshima Manju. Right, so I looked at all the instances of trademarks from 1998 to 2015. And so you also do see waxing and waning, and I overlaid this with tensions. And that was sort of my way of getting at not only gauging this level of commodification, but also quantification and how that relates to tensions. Just a bit on policy implications. What to take away? First, there's an approach to think about tensions as just being there without having much human agency. But if you think about tensions and nationalism in a consumption manner, you can see how there is a lot of human agency behind tensions. And the fact that nationalism requires a lot of momentum and effort. And it's a very different approach to thinking about tensions that way. And also, specifically going back to my typology of tensions, you prevent yourself from misdiagnosing war prospects because maybe volume and intensity don't go hand in hand. Maybe commodification has different impact. Just to summarize, so I told you about tensions, how nationalism and commodification of nationalism affects tensions. And I want to give you this great quote from an interview that I did with the CEO of Tokto Bread in 2015. He said, "To be honest, there is still a negative societal perception that patriots and profits don't mix. But in the end, it's money that enables the patriots to protect their country. You can't avoid the issue of money." And this gets to this my idea about how the marketplace and political activity interact. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, June. Next, I would like to invite Stephen Denny to take the podium. You already know a little bit about Stephen Denny from the beginning panel, and he's already gave us a bit of a teaser into his presentation of identity in South Korea. And just again, Stephen, he's a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto and a doctoral fellow at the Asian Institute at the Monk School of Global Affairs. I don't need to do another plug of sinonk.com. Just kidding. But today, Stephen, he's going to go a little more in depth and share his findings and observations from his long-term project on measuring and understanding ethnic nationalism of Koreans, especially of resettled North Korean migrants in South Korea, and sharing those findings and implications for nationalism and national identity. So, Stephen, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good morning and greetings. To you, what does it mean to be truly South Korean? Since the early 1990s, a slow but certain demographic transition has been underway in the Republic of Korea. An influx of migrants, international brides, and non-ethnic Koreans has been chipping away at the notion that South Korea is an ethnically homogeneous nation. This process of change has precipitated a new discourse on South Korean nationhood and what it means to be South Korean. And it has led some to conclude that ethnic nationalism is on the decline, that ethnicity or race is no longer the defining component of Korean national identity. So today I'm going to challenge that conclusion by providing a snippet of an ongoing project into the study of South Korean national identity by looking at resettled North Korean migrants. Here's some basic questions to help orient your mind. I'm going to provide some answers over the course of my discussion today, and I will read them with you. What can North Korean migrants tell us about identity change or non-change in contemporary South Korea? And what are the lessons for Korea and beyond? As I mentioned, there are a number of contemporary scholars who have concluded, based upon various research, that ethnic nationalism in South Korea is on the decline or has been eroded or has gone away. Here you can see a brief snippet of some of the articles that have been published, including one from Catherine Moon. A lot of the research has been based upon public opinion data. When I was at the Asan Institute for Policy Studies in Seoul, this data came out in 2003. And these are answers to the question, to be truly Korean, is it important to have the Korean bloodline? And as you can see, there is a difference between younger people and older people. Younger people think it's less important. Older people think it's more important. This has led some to conclude that because of generational effects, or the differences in the conditions under which people come of age, that Korean ethnicity is no longer a defining feature or predominant feature of South Korean national identity. I want to challenge this conclusion, and I think it's due to a silo problem. It's interesting, silo has come up many times already, and I did not know that this word was going to be used so much. But let's talk about the silo. And what I mean by silo here is the idea that for South Koreans, you are born in Korea, you go to school in Korea, you graduate from Korea, you get married in Korea, and you have a job there. People leave for the obligatory UOK, but do they really settle down? Do they really take on a new identity? Not really. Most people know themselves and others from their own national context. Age, in other words, which is often used as an explanatory variable to predict or to explain an outcome, such as what people think about national identity, is perfectly correlated with exposure. So how do we know what the impact that growing up in South Korea today has on what people think about national identity? Can we talk to young South Koreans of college age and ask them, do you think ethnicity is important to be truly in South Korea? We'll give you an answer. But what will they think in 15 years from now? And how do we know what the impact of growing up in South Korea today has on this answer? The data that I showed you a moment ago here, it's a snippet in time. It's in 2013. Unfortunately, we don't have data going back to 1975 to compare how the answers have varied or not over time. So what South Korean people think today at the age 25 may be what South Korea people in 1975 at the age 25 also thought. It's hard to say what exactly they might have answered because we don't have the data. Hence, you know, we're contributing to this silo problem. So how do we get around this? Well, there are ways, and I'm going to present one. Since the early 2000s, picking up in the mid-2000s, a number of North Korean defectors, migrants, refugees, I'll allow you to choose your preferred word, have begun resettling in South Korea. Today, there are about 29,000 of them, ethnic Koreans who were born elsewhere, grew up elsewhere, North Korea, who have resettled in South Korea. They can help us overcome the silo problem. They are ethnically Korean, yet they did not grow up in South Korea. In other words, for this group of people, age is not perfectly correlated with exposure. You can measure the impact that being in South Korea has on an ethnic Korean group. So this is where I begin. I've just returned about 2 weeks ago from South Korea, where I was for about 6 months, doing a collaborative project, with a number of colleagues who happen to be a part of Sino-NK. of resettled North Korean migrants in South Korea. I've surveyed 350 people using a battery of questions, of which I will report on some of the answers from one category, the national identity category. I also did about 120 interviews. This part's still ongoing from the original 350, but I'm only going to talk a bit about the survey responses. We can talk about what I learned from my interviews informally if you wish, or in the Q&A session. I'm going to report on 250 because the last 100 actually just came in about a week ago, and I have to input it. And for those of you who do data input, you know how long that takes. So I'm giving you a snippet, or a part of the 350. So 250. And here are some basic descriptives. I will give you a few seconds to read through them. I will note that it stays consistent even after adding the additional 100. About 70%, roughly 70% of my sample is female, which is consistent with the number of females who are defectors in South Korea, which is 70%. So how do you measure the salience of ethnicity, the importance of ethnicity, or ethnic nationalism? I showed you one variable. It's a question that asks very specifically, is the bloodline important to being Korean? Well, there are other variables that are also considered important to the measure of this concept. And they are being born in Korea or any national country, having the bloodline as mentioned, and living one's most life there. So what I've done is I've taken the scores, the responses for these three questions, I've coded and combined and created a new variable called the ethnic score. And it measures the salience of ethnicity to national identity based upon the responses given in my survey. Here are comparative ethnic scores from my sample, the North Korean migrants, and from the South Koreans from the data I showed you previously. It's quite similar. You'll see that the average score for North Korean migrants is slightly higher. This would be expected. Ethnicity is, from what we know empirically and theoretically about how it's treated in North Korea, is a more salient component of the national discourse than it is in South Korea today. Also, the conditions of existence in North Korea are the type of conditions that would produce a stronger sense of ethnic nationalism in the country. Crisis, disconnectedness internationally, and so on. But still, the trajectories for both populations is roughly the same. Even if you just looked at the South Korean data, you would see that there is a linear progression with regards to the salience of ethnicity. But as we said, there's a silo problem. So it's dangerous to conclude based upon data for only South Koreans that it is due to some effect, be it generational, be it a life cycle effect, that is, that age is what explains how someone answers, or some other effect. But inserting the North Korean migrant data, for a group for whom exposure is disaggregated from age, we can start to think about what's going on here for Koreans living in South Korea today. So what I propose here, and this is only preliminary, but I've got some support for it, which I'm going to elaborate on in a moment. What explains the salience of ethnicity, or how important ethnicity is to being South Korean today, is age. As you age, it will become more important. And this is consistent with findings in political science and sociology, which suggests that as you get older, you tend to be more conservative. Well, what I think I'm seeing in my data is as you get older, you become more ethnically nationalist, is a way to think about it. For those of you who do statistics, you'll recognize this right away. For those of you who do not, I will explain it very simply. It's an ordinary least squared regression using my data. And I want to comment on something what I've done with the age variable, is I've transformed it to take into account not life cycle effects, but social learning. This idea that what you learn in younger years of life have more impact on you. So what happens to you at 12, 14, 16 will have a more lasting, enduring effect on you than what happens to you at 36. So I've transformed the data to take into account of this. And what I found, simply, is that the only statistically significant predictor of the ethnic score is age. The control variables which I use, which are quite interesting, I don't want to get into here now, but if you would like to talk more about them later, please ask. So here are some of my preliminary conclusions, and I emphasize that they're only preliminary, and I will read them. The older a North Korean migrant is, the more likely it is that she or he will see ethnicity as a salient component of Korean national identity. This conclusion likely holds true for South Koreans as well. Second, like other political attitudes, identity seems partially determined by age. Third, taking into account the effects of social learning, neither time spent in North Korea nor time spent in South Korea significantly affect the salience of ethnicity. In other words, what's doing the explaining here is age. In short, ethnic nationalism may not be on the decline. Implications for further consideration. Given what I've presented you with here today, I want you to think about these two things, sort of bigger questions. First, is ethnic nationalism compatible with democratic or liberal democratic norms? I think not. And that might be problematic for a future South Korea. And a slightly more positive consideration, the second, what will be the role of ethnic nationalism in a post-unification scenario? I want to call upon, just briefly, some of my experiences in doing my 100-plus interviews. North Korean migrants are integrating relatively well, especially the older migrants. And the one thing that holds consistent across age groups is that they feel, in part or in whole, a member of South Korean society because of a shared ethnicity. Rogers Brubaker has admonished us to not always think of ethnic nationalism as an entirely bad thing, because it isn't. Times of crisis, as we see on the peninsula regularly, reproduced. It can be a mechanism for the production of social solidarity, and I think that might be happening. And I wonder to what extent that happened in post-unification Germany or in wartime Poland. So with these two large questions, I will conclude. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. Now I'd like to invite our final presenter, Julie Young, to the podium. So Julie Young, she's the manager of international public relations at the Ladies Professional Golf Association, where her primary interest is the economic and social opportunity that professional golf provides for women and girls. Most fittingly, Julie would take the themes of identity and power from the angle of women's golf diplomacy, which has helped to stir nationalism and is used as a form of soft power in South Korea. And the floor is yours, Julie.
Hi, everyone. If I could get a show of hands of anyone that actually plays golf in the audience. Who thinks of golf as a diplomatic tool? All right, I have a tough crowd to persuade here, I guess. So be brave and young. Thank you for that. I myself never really thought of golf or sports as being a very heavily diplomatic tool. I was studying at Georgetown on global politics and security, the traditional realms of diplomacy. I don't know how many of you are aware that the LPGA is very big in Asia. The athletes are national icons there. And I think that golf showed me that the growing influence of Asia is also seen in the sports realm. So I'll go through some of the facts and figures during the presentation, but I hope that by the end of today, you see golf as not just being an old man's sport, but something that provides young women with economic opportunities and is something that really brings countries closer together. And just a quick disclaimer that my lawyers insisted that I include. The views today are entirely my own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the LPGA or any other organization, Georgetown or other, that I may be affiliated with. Now, my thesis is that golf diplomacy has transitioned from a heavily male-dominated stage that was primarily for state officials to currently a form of sports diplomacy that's largely non-governmental actors, such as, you know, private citizens and also corporate actors and professional women athletes. And so what do I mean by sports diplomacy? Sports diplomacy is when you enhance international exchange and understanding between countries through sports, and also how countries can use sports and sporting events to generate and further establish their own soft power. As I was looking through the existing literature on sports diplomacy, I've noticed that there wasn't too much out there, and I hope that this discussion and going further, that the more literature about the potential and promise of sports diplomacy is further enhanced. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Dr. Victor Cha's book, Beyond the Final Score, and I think that really did push the envelope in terms of generating more dialogue about how sports can serve as a diplomatic tool. If I could just pull very quickly from his book to help sort of provide a basis for sports diplomacy. Dr. Victor Cha wrote that sport matters in world politics because it can create diplomatic breakthroughs or breakdowns in ways unanticipated by regular diplomacy. And just like how the white ping pong ball thawed relations between U.S. and China post-Cold War, I see that the white golf ball is a way that countries in Asia, as well as in Europe and the United States, can be drawn closer together. So the evolution of professional women's golf in Korea. How many of you are familiar with this face? Sari Park. She really was the first Korean player in the LPGA. In 1998, she won the U.S. Women's Open, and this year she's actually retiring. When she first started in 1998, she was one of hundreds of players that was she was only the only Korean player. And 10 years later, you had 45 Korean players in the LPGA. Today, you have more than 50 players, many of which are in the top 10 highest earning players in the LPGA. She was also the youngest to win the U.S. Women's Open, which is one of the major championships on the tour. And there was this iconic image of her shooting a golf ball out of a water hazard. She took off her socks and entered the water, showing the sign of really commitment and dedication to the game. And 1998 was a year when Korea was undergoing a very difficult financial crisis. And so Sari Park's win on a global stage really provided the country with a beacon of hope, and it was a source of pride for the country when internationally Korea was being known to not being in the best financial state, but to have this woman athlete bring home this trophy was really a source of pride for the country. Fast forward to 2016, Korea again wins the gold medal in the golf in the Rio Olympics. And this was the first time that golf had re-entered the Olympics after more than 112 years. And so it was no big surprise, I think, to many that MB Park, she brought home the gold, New Zealand brought home the silver, and China brought home the bronze. And again, the golf would be entering the Olympics in 2020 in Tokyo, after which it's going to be determined whether or not golf will continue to be an Olympic sport. But what we've seen through the Olympics is golf being elevated to this international stage. A few weeks ago, the Chinese bronze winner had said that China divides its sports into Olympics and non-Olympics. And as a result of the golf being re-entered into the Olympics, she foresees it being treated somewhat differently within the country, perhaps more investment from the government into the sport and more interest from the general public. Just a quick look back at golf diplomacy before the Olympics and before it was on the center stage in Korea. U.S.-Japan had conducted what was golf ball diplomacy. Here we have Prime Minister Nobusuke Kishi and former President Eisenhower playing golf. And there's a great excerpt from a journal, Diplomacy and Statecraft, that was titled Golf Ball Diplomacy Between Former President Richard Nixon and the Prime Ministers of Japan During the Late 1960s. And I'll give you some time to just quickly read through it. But former President Nixon had used golf balls as a gesture to help further establish relations with Japan. And the former Prime Minister, Kishi, had said that his kind greeting symbolized the beginning of the end of tense U.S.-Japan relations and golf ball diplomacy. And at the time, Japan was considered the golf capital of the world. And, you know, I think many view that now as being Korea, given its prominence on the LPGA and its performance at the Olympics. This is an interesting headline from the early 1980s in Malaysia, whether golf diplomacy is on its way out. And we see here President Obama has used golf extensively for diplomacy. On the upper left, you have President Obama playing golf with the Prime Minister of Malaysia, Najib. And so, you know, the fact that the question of whether golf diplomacy is on its way out, I think that these images show that it's still pretty heavily conducted in the diplomatic field. Then what are the policy implications of this increase in professional women golfers on the global stage? The economic impact of how Korea's exporting its athletes. Each country has their own golf league, but then the LPGA and there's other regional golf leagues that Korea has been sort of sending off its athletes to. In the LPGA alone, like I had said, there's more than 50 athletes that are waving the Korean flag. And what does that economic impact have? A lot of the tournaments have purses that are over $1 million. And so how that the contributions to the economy that these women athletes are bringing back home is pretty impressive. Private sector participation. The tournaments used to be sponsored heavily by, you know, U.S. companies or other Western companies, and now increasingly you see major Japanese companies, Korean companies, Taiwan nonprofit organizations sponsoring these tournaments, and how that provides a platform for many of these companies to raise their brand globally. Female participation in the workforce and tourism. Just in 2016 alone, we have 33 tournaments that are being conducted in over 16 countries, and that in and of itself is an economic driver. You know, when each tournament is coming home to these countries, and it provides an opportunity for fans and athletes to engage. The social impact, and we had spoken earlier about the issue of identity and ethnicity, and I think that sports, and specifically women professional athletes, provide a great opportunity for women to be empowered and to be a part of the economy and to elevate the image of not the submissive Asian woman, but, you know, a very strong image of being at the tee box and, you know, whipping the driver and sending the ball hundreds of yards down. I think that question of what is identity, what is the Asian, what is the Korean woman's identity, can also be further explored. In terms of ethnicity, does sports create a new category of ethnicity? Many of the professional women golfers that we see were born in Korea and yet are waving a different flag now. The number one golfer in the world, Lydia Ko, was born in Korea, but she is New Zealand and she waves a New Zealand flag and played for New Zealand at the Olympics. Has that category of ethnicity changed in sports? Is something I think that's further to be considered. Haru Nomura is another athlete that's high profile. She has a Japanese and Korean parent, and how that changes her ethnicity and identity has been an interesting category as well. And lastly, foreign policy. How golf, and I alluded to it earlier in terms of soft power, but how does golf and international sports improve bilateral and international relations, if not create some tension in terms of competition between the two countries? How can serve as a way to increase soft power, provide national prestige and national unity? We spoke briefly about how nationalism can be consumed, and I think that many of the fans in Korea and elsewhere, by going to these tournaments and watching the tournaments online, is a way of consuming nationalism through sports. And lastly, I'm curious to see how China further advances their sports development with the recent win in the bronze in the Olympics. This is a painting from ancient China that shows women back then playing golf, and the origin of golf is still debated. Sometimes the Chinese say that it was originated there. Scotland has a different point of view. But I think that this painting is fascinating to see how early on women were playing sports and something similar to golf. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Julie. I would like to ask for all our panelists to go ahead and take seats and we can start the discussion. So first, I would just like to use my power as the moderator discussant to provide some of my own thoughts and questions for our panelists before moving on to Q&A with the audience. So just to briefly recap, our panel is about identity and power, and just looking at how identity power is defined as commercial interests, how it's produced, reproduced, North Korean migrants settling in South Korea, and how they look at their national personal identities, and in some ways not as much different with South Koreans in terms of ethnic nationalism. And also looking at women and gender identity in South Korea as a soft power through this golf diplomacy, which we just heard from Julie. So first, I just want to say that I'm quite intrigued by June's presentation. Just applying this idea of nationalism as a commodity, as economics, business, who is profiting, you know, who is not profiting from this type of thinking, and how it's produced and reproduced for consumption by citizens. And I think we could apply this idea not only thinking about territorial disputes between South Korea and Japan, but also maybe somehow apply to our other presenters' topics. Just sort of looking at the changing characteristics of consumers, the citizens of South Korea, and the idea of this ethnic nationalism being continually repackaged. And also even nationalism being culturally exported in the form of sport diplomacy and being a tool to use in other countries. So there are a couple questions I want to ask the entire panel. Hopefully this makes sense. So one thing I want to start is just looking at inside South Korea. And I want to ask you, in terms of this commodified nationalism, and how is this passed down to the younger generations? So I know that right now we have this focus of how strong and strengthened nationalism is in terms of perhaps profit, looking at sort of actual like consumer goods or experiences, and also looking at sort of Stephen's surveys on the different generations and how they associate themselves with that identity, and also in terms of looking at women and girls and in terms of promoting sort of this identity and nationalism and exporting that in the profit or the good of South Korea. So I'd like to start with Chiyun, and we'll work our way to the right, if that's fine with you.
Great, thank you. So the question is, how is commodification of nationalism passed down to the younger generation? And that's a very, very interesting point, because I'm trying to think about or coin these sort of terms of, so there's, on the one hand, you have what I'm calling retail nationalism. It's, but you need infrastructure, you need overhead. So something like Tokdo Ramen, when I was talking to the CEO of Tokdo Ramen, which by the way was very tasty, he was telling me how he was losing profit because it takes so much money to make the product. And so he really, at this point, is doing it for his own enjoyment and benefit. And so on the one hand, you have something like retail nationalism, which requires a lot of investment and money. And I think if you're someone who's young and don't necessarily have the money, then maybe that isn't as accessible. But on the other hand, you have something that I'm tentatively calling artisanal nationalism. And that's more micro-level. There's a great website that sells comfort women related products, but they're not, nothing is very gaudy about them. They are very well made. They are actually very aesthetically appealing. And I think that's what makes it more artisanal. And that they only, they just need a website, and they do very micro level processing and manufacturing. And so if you're someone who's younger and you have that sort of technological platform, then artisanal nationalism could very well be a channel for you to get your ideas out there and use the marketplace for political activity. And I think that's sort of how I see the connection to the younger generation in commodification of nationalism, at least in my case.
Just to confirm, I'm answering the same question, Eileen.
Yes,
right?
Yeah.
Okay. Jiyun's work is really interesting, and I want to sort of continue along the same thread of commodification, and then I'll make a comment that's perhaps more related to my own work. How is a particular identity passed from one generation to the next? I think it's a quite common phenomenon, and I think we are always in danger of, or actually just doing this, assuming that because we have a new generation, 25 years have passed or conditions have changed, however you want to define a generation, that people who constitute that generation will think differently. They'll have a different identity. And I think we understate the power that parents have and the ease with which certain ideas are reproduced. In South Korea, for instance, one element that is, I would say, integral to the contemporary national identity is a certain anti-Japanese sentiment. It was founded in the colonial period. Many of you know the story. This is continually reproduced, and it's commodified, and the commodification itself reproduces it. If you look at the way in which An Jung-gun, who is the fellow in 1909 who shot and eventually killed Ito Hirabumi at a Harbin train station. He is a martyr. He is a national hero. And he is reproduced regularly in textbooks and schools and in plays, commodification. And that reproduces a certain national identity that may not necessarily change with this new age, with this era of ease of travel and internationalism and all these great isms and ideas about who we are as a young generation. I think it's remarkable how similar we are to our parents. And I don't think we should overlook that because it's vitally important. Further to that, so that's my comic sort of connecting it to June's work, which is very interesting. I also think identity is, you know, in addition to the reproduction of certain identities and the passing of ideas from parents to children, I think my work is suggesting that we should not overstate the influence of age and sort of natural life processes. I didn't go into my questions. I didn't go into my work thinking that that was what I was going to find. I was using age as the explanatory variable because that's what a lot of people are using, and it's a really interesting variable to see how things change as you get older. That's kind of what we're talking about today, isn't it? And you see that as you get older, you become more conservative. Why? Well, you get married, you get a job, you settle down. And when you do things like this, certain things tend to happen. And in the literature, I talked about in political science, sociology, and elsewhere, common sense, you become more conservative. And I think there's a relationship between that and what people think makes you whatever national identity. And I want to emphasize, I don't think it's just South Korea. I think it's here in the US and Canada. And the data kind of suggests it too, if you look at it. As one gets older, as you look across age, what it means, like ethnicity, which is a question that I asked my respondents, is a question that's been reproduced in other surveys. I just took from an existing survey that's been asked cross-nationally for about a decade and a half, and you see similar trends. I think that should make us a little uncomfortable, but we can't deny it, can we? Because life goes on, and certain processes take place.
I guess I'll start by defining nationalism in terms of sports. I see nationalism as being a sense that your country is superior, right? Is the best, and often the reason why the Olympics is such a popular worldwide event with, you know, viewership extremely high is because I think that it fuels that sense of nationalism, and there's so much pride behind an investment behind the gold medals because it shows undisputably that country is the best, right? Is superior in that specific sport. And I see that the players in the LPGA and other professional golf leagues is that they're playing not just for themselves, but they're playing on behalf of the country. And so when you see a leaderboard that ranks all the countries for each tournament, it's not just their name. They have their country's flag right next to it. And I think that many of the athletes also go in thinking that they're playing on behalf of their country, that they are sort of a national champion, and as a result, are national icons once they return home. I mean, there's ceremonies at the airport and flowers and fans and press whenever these athletes return home to their country after a win. And so fueling that sense of nationalism and providing that national pride through golf and through sports, I think, has been fascinating for me. And the conference is called Young and Brave, but I would say that many of the young athletes that are playing professional golf right now are really the young and brave champions, because the average age is like 18 or 20, in the very early 20s, and they're going into different countries and playing on behalf of their country and themselves. And so I think seeing that unfold is a very interesting new form of nationalism.
Great, thank you. Just leading off from that, I kind of want to shift the panel discussion to the exporting of nationalism. So we've been looking within the views of South Korea and looking at national identity viewed by Koreans. And I'm curious about how this commodity of nationalism is exported to, say, the U.S. For instance, in my own experience in regards to seeing like Korean American groups in LA or in DC, New York, you do sometimes see the Dokdo label on newsletters for grocery stores, or you see a sticker maybe just posted onto the walls, like sort of graffiti art. So I'm kind of curious about what is, Gian, your take on this exporting nationalism as a commodity to the U.S. or to other countries, and mostly it's advocated by the groups here. So I wanted to start with you first on that.
Great. So the question of exporting the commodity of nationalism. So in LA, it's quite frequent that you see something like Tokdo Moving Company driving around the city. And I believe there's Tokdo Wine in California. And I've been wanting to meet with the CEO to see his take on how he got it started. But to me, so my own work here that I explained was mainly on domestic consumption. And that's why it's different from something like militarization, which is more action-reaction across borders. Because I'm looking at how nationalism as an identity is consumed within borders domestically, but with impacts across borders. And so when I think about something like exports, I'm hesitant to think that it is an export, because you rarely see, for one, non-Koreans in the business. It's mainly of Korean ethnicity that are getting into this sort of commodification. And so I'm not sure, it's a different space, but it's the same people doing the work. And so for me, I'm very hesitant to say that this export then has any different effect as it does domestically within South Korea. But I don't think, it's a very interesting question. I'm still on the fence about how I feel about the impact of exports. But to me, I don't think it really is an export, because the effects are still the same, and the same people do the commodification.
Great, thank you. I have one follow-up question for Stephen. You mentioned in the beginning of your PowerPoint, you opened up sort of dramatically in regards to the changing ethnic nationalism in Korea. And you also mentioned not just North Korean resettled groups, but also maybe migrant workers from other countries, or maybe there's also like Chinese Koreans or others who are a diversification of this ethnic Korean identity. And I was curious whether you ever thought of, from your long-term project, whether or not using that framework, this also applies to this group of ethnic Koreans, in this minority, and just your views on that. And also, I'm curious about, with time, let's say, you know, hopefully you could continue your research for decades or for many years from now. And I'm just curious if you could still hold fact to that as you age, you tend to be more ethnically nationalist.
Thank you. So two questions I took from that. What do I think, or what is the potential for understanding the phenomenon that I'm interested in with other groups who have resettled in South Korea, such as Chinese Koreans, migrant laborers, and so on? And the second is about reproduction of the surveys and of findings. So the first question, I'm glad you brought it up. So I want to tell you, I attempted the, you start very ambitiously in the dissertation project, and you sort of narrow it down as time goes on because you're confronted with financial, emotional, and psychological limitations. I wanted to include, as a second group, Chinese Koreans, either those who were born and raised in Yenbian, the autonomous prefecture in Jilin province, or Chinese Koreans in South Korea, of which there are hundreds of thousands. I still might include, maybe not for the dissertation, but at some point, the Chinese-Korean group. And it would indeed be interesting to survey them using the same questions. Because it matters that in my study, I was looking at North Koreans. Because it's taking advantage of what some might call a natural experiment. You have a divided peninsula, a divided people, who then grow up and come of age under fundamentally different structural conditions, political, social, and otherwise. And how does this affect a number of things? Well, I'm looking at identity. So the fact that they moved themselves from North Korea to South Korea and resettled has opened up a really interesting avenue of inquiry that's been reproduced elsewhere in Germany and has been done in a similar fashion in North America, looking at people in Saskatchewan and North Dakota who are otherwise similar but are in Canada and the United States, which are different places. So maybe I'll be writing something about the Chinese Koreans who have settled. The other groups, I don't know what to do. So if we're looking at migrant laborers, who are from, I don't know, Bangladesh, what do we ask them? What do we want to know about them? How apart do they feel of South Korean society? I can tell you it's not very. They don't feel very integrated. But what about the children of international marriages? Data shows that South Koreans see them as basically Korean. They see them as more part of South Korean society than they see Chinese Koreans, for instance. So exploring those interesting outcomes is something I want to do. The second part, just doing research going forward, I think that, especially in the social sciences and science perhaps in general, there is a tendency to have a finding, to make a splash, and then go do something else. But reproduction is sort of the essence of scientific inquiry, isn't it? To see whether or not what you're finding is actually true. You need it, 2, 3, 4 times before it can be considered an actual finding. So if you're from a funding agency out there and you find my work interesting, talk to me on the side afterwards, because I am very interested in continuing to do it. Really, I am. With my collaborators, we are most interested in continuing this project after we're all doing our PhDs, but after we do them, we want to continue doing it. To see whether what we're finding is an actual finding or is an aberration or is due to some other effect. So yeah, I'm very open to doing that. I want to.
Okay, great. Thank you, Stephen. I think I abused my power as a moderator because I only left you 10 minutes to ask some questions to... Okay, 15 minutes. Great. Thank you. So we're going to have a mic go around and I will select you and I ask that you please identify yourself. So, sir, in the front...
Hi, Chris McRae, World Class Brands. I'd like to sort of congratulate everyone in terms of putting a focus both on sports and national identities. Actually, 25 years ago, I've been researching fast-moving consumer goods brands all through the 80s, and we found there was a problem that the classical model was one product, one brand, one country. Basically, there were no platforms for going global, so basically, sports and national identities have been borrowed by brands over the last 25 years. So my question is, how do you use the sort of risks and opportunities of that to actually be brave for young people under 35's goals like sustainability or whatever your goals are, given that in a way, what you're looking at is sort of at the nexus between how these things have been manipulated the last 25 years by big concerns, but where you maybe want to go as a generation which is either borderless or has, you know, issues which are unique to your times.
That was great. Thank you for that really insightful question. I think you're right. A lot of corporations now, you know, traditional marketing for the younger generation has been shifting more towards sponsoring sporting events or trying to move towards sort of the online and what the younger generation is consuming. And that's often not so much products, but it is sporting events and other activities and experiences. So absolutely. And your second part of the question, I'm sorry.
I'm particularly interested in your organization because, many of the big sports organizations actually own their superstars to a large degree, and you appear to be saying, in a way, that your young stars had more freedom to choose what they stood for. Is that what you did say, or, and if so, how could you use the advantage of ladies' professional golf in that direction?
Sure. I think so many of the players have issues that they are personally passionate about, whether that's breast cancer awareness, heart health, and often some of the tournaments are also do charity pro-ams and associate themselves with a charity that often if the players do like a hole-in-one or a birdie, then a certain amount will go to charities identified before the game. But I think that, you know, you see the younger generation and some of the athletes perhaps using their platform to promote issues that are concern to them. From the LPGA perspective, it's often woman empowerment, right? How do you provide women with a career track? And I think what Sari Park had showed Korea in the 1998 was that professional golf can be a viable career track that provides a global recognition for women to succeed. And I think that's what's really fascinating in Korea right now is that, you know, what's a category where you see Korean women really being at the forefront globally? And I would have to say from my point of view right now, it's currently only golf where you see a very global recognition that they're sort of developing their own career. And that, I think, is something that might speak to your question.
Okay, thank you. I want to take a couple questions to Darcy in the back. And
let her answer that first. Thanks. Hi, I'm Darcy Drow, and I'm with Johns Hopkins University. I have, as a student of citizenship, this is particularly interesting to me as you kind of parse the different contours of Korean ethnic or other aspects of Korean identity. So I have two related questions to Stephen and to Julie. The first is to Stephen, looking at your data driven from North Korean migrants living in South Korea. I wonder if you could kind of discuss the contours of how you distinguish North Korean national identity, ethnic identity, and nationalism, because it seems that there's a couple steps that need to be made in order to make some claims about national ethnic nationalism, especially if you're looking at a population that necessarily has a different relationship to the South Korean state than South Korean, ethnic Korean South Koreans. I'm clear. And then that's probably a lot of jargon. And then to Julie, you mentioned how in the case of the migration of a lot of these athletes, they take on different citizenships. So, for example, Lydia Ko now has New Zealand citizenship, but she was born in South Korea, and still, you know, a lot of Koreans identify her as part of the diaspora. So I wonder if you could kind of just explain a little bit about how these migrated athletes, how different populations receive these athletes. How does New Zealand receive Lydia Ko, and how does South Korea see Lydia Ko, for example? Thanks.
Great. No, I would like to take another question to this gentleman right here.
Hi, my name is Phil Wilcox. I'm a former graduate student at USC and former classmate of Dr. Jun Bong. And this is a question for first of all, I want to say it's a very interesting seminar, and it's very thought-provoking as well. Questions for you, Dr. Jun Bong, but other people can contribute as well. I'm a student for Chinese nationalism, but it translates to South Korea as well. For example, in Chinese nationalism, especially after Tiananmen, there was the Patriotic Education Campaign, which focused a lot on anti-Japanese sentiment to teaching for children. But the Chinese government found that it's very difficult to control these nationalist sentiments. They found it as a negative. And also, recently, in a recent panel at Brookings, said because of a lot of tourism, which is something you mentioned, June, of China to Japan, and the relatively positive feedback from the tourists returning back to China, that especially the young generation, that tendency is sort of diminished. Like, the people aren't as upset about Japan as they might have been before. But you focus more about tourism to those contested territories, which is different in a sense, which doesn't really happen as much for the Diaoyutai or Senkaku Islands. People don't usually go to those islands as tourist events. So I was wondering, maybe there's any experience of South Koreans traveling to Japan, if that might, especially younger generation, if that might reduce the impact of like nationalism amongst those younger generation people, or if it's just different, just go to the islands themselves. So it's a pretty different aspect of going to specific countries rather than going to those contested territories. So thank you very much.
So how about we work from to my right, and also take the opportunity if you want to add any closing remarks to your presentation, or just sort of wrap it up for your own points. Thank you.
Thanks, Darcy, for that question. I think, as I said earlier, you know, really defining the definition of identity has changed, I think, over increasingly as we see in sports. What does an identity mean? Even outside of sports, Dr. Moon was earlier mentioning how many of us have lived in different countries for extensive periods of time and speak different languages. Do we, even outside of sports, have a very singular identity? And I think that's a question that our generation has to really consider deeply. In terms of sports, I think that you see after a tournament, an athlete will win, and they'll often drape their country flag over them when they receive the trophy, and that symbol in and of itself is often a self-identification. So recently in the Evian Championship, In Ji Chun won, and she's from Korea, and so they draped her in a Korean flag, and Lydia Ko would drape herself in a New Zealand flag, which she did at the Olympics as well. And I think that, you know, really self-selecting in a way what country you choose to identify with, which flag you choose to wave when you're playing on an international stage, has become a way to define one's identity. But it's really something I think that might need further academic studying, is how identity is different in sports versus in other categories.
Thanks again to Darcy for the good questions. Darcy, stop me if I don't get it quite right, like if I did not quite understand your question. But you're saying that what we have here are two different groups of people who I'm asking the same question about a national identity of one of the countries to which one of the groups exclusively belongs to. I'm making an assumption that both groups self-identify as ethnic Koreans. And I could, in theory, include, given my interest and my design, any ethnic Koreans anywhere. Because in part, what I'm looking at here is whether or not being elsewhere has any effect on your answer, because these people move. The group that the North Korean migrants in this case move, so I can, in theory, measure the impact that being in different locations has on their responses. And I think it's worth pointing out, too, that I'm reproducing questions, the exact same questions that were asked to South Koreans, for the resettled North Korean migrants. So I'm asking them, what does it mean to be truly... sometimes they translate it as Korean, which can be a bit misleading, because it's Hangukin, which means South Korean, probably. So what does it mean to be truly South Korean? And then you have seven different endings to the beginning of that question, and I was focusing on three of them. So what I ended up looking at here was whether growing up in North Korea, being in China, and then being in South Korea has any effect on how they perceived the important qualities of South Korean national identity. And the answer is that it doesn't. Did that answer the question, Darcy? I feel like it didn't. Well, we should talk with everyone. But, I mean, yeah, that's all I have to say about that.
So, Phil, thank you for being a great colleague and putting me on the spot. I think twofold. So the first question about you bringing up China, I think it gets to this term that social scientists are in love with, which is generalizability. How generalizable is my theory? And I can assure you, I did look at China and its dispute with Diaoyutai Senkaku with Japan. And it's fascinating because, in a way, it tracks really well with what Pu Hung said and Dr. Moon said about money talking in China. Money really talks, because
it's not very capitalist in that way, where you see a lot of commodification of nationalism surrounding Daiyotai Senkaku. And I briefly looked at the number of trademarks under Daiyotai in China, and there's a lot of registered trademarks. And this gets to the second point about state power and how is, you mentioned the idea of state being able to or not being able to control this sense of nationalism and the activity surrounding nationalism. And it's a great question because I think the state itself is trying to negotiate its power, and especially when nationalism becomes embedded in this marketplace. And in a way, I think there is a very important role for the state, though, still, regardless of gatekeeping nationalism. And if I can, I just wanted to bring up one slide. If AV, oh, okay. So I myself was interested in how the state was negotiating its power with all this commercial activity, right? And so I decided to look at, I'm hoping it will magically appear. So I looked at how the patent office actually gatekeeps which trademarks it decides to accept and which it decides to reject. And because it's a very interesting case, because if you look at South Korea, there's an accumulative total of 129 applications that have been accepted between 98, oh, here we go. Between 98 to 2014, you have 129 applications, but then you actually have 230 rejections. So in a way, you have more rejections than applications. And so the patent office itself is also very conscious about its role of gatekeeping, what gets filtered and what doesn't. And so in this way, you also see the state negotiating its power that way and controlling. And so my final remark just goes back to Eileen's great comment about thinking about who is profiting and who is not. Something I wanted to share, which is interesting. So under the Dokdo Sustainable Use Project, DSUP, you see that the number of ministries that got money to get involved in Dokdo increased from 2 to 12, and the budget increased from 5 million to 650 million by 2013. And there's a great chart that I wanted to show that shows who is actually getting the most, the bulk of that money, which is not the foreign ministry, which we love to talk about in terms of this territorial dispute. It is, drum roll, it's actually Ministry of Fisheries. And it's because they building things costs a lot of money. And so they get, they saw a budget increase of over 15,000% from 2004 to 2013. And 62% of that money goes to facilities construction and management. And that was an increase of 23,000% over the same period. And so thinking about who is profiting and who is not, I think is a very great question.
So that brings us to the close of our panel. I would like to thank our panelists here to share their expertise with us today. I do not want to keep us any longer from lunch, so we will break until 12:30 for our next panel. And let's go ahead and congratulate our excellent panelists today.